opening verses of Nahum, and we say they're a wonderful introduction to the book because they describe the angry God who will destroy Nineveh. And when the bell rang, I was in the act of mentioning four things here which reveal the greatness of God's anger. First is there are at least 10 distinct statements of his anger. Then the second is that there are 6 different words by which the Holy Spirit describes the anger of God. Now the first one is jealous. That first thing we find about God in Nahum, that he's the jealous God. Why do we have to destroy Nineveh? Because Nineveh has violated God's jealousy. Jealousy means insistence upon exclusive affection. Before I give you some definite references to God's jealousy in the Bible, I want to give you what I consider to be one of the greatest, but it doesn't use the word jealousy. Remember, when you trace the thought, you aren't confined to a particular word in tracing the thought. It's just Colossians 1:18, that in all things Christ might have the preeminence. See, preeminence has to do with his being the one and only. That's one of the greatest verses on God's jealousy in the Bible, although it doesn't use the particular word jealousy. God must be the one and only. Otherwise, his jealousy burns with an infinite burning. I wonder how many of you know what's the first direct reference to God's jealousy in the Bible. I'm using here Dr. A.T. Pearson's law called the law of first mention. First time something's mentioned in the Bible, generally speaking, is a key passage. You know the first one? It's in one of the most familiar parts of all Scripture, in part of the Ten Commandments. And it comes in Exodus chapter 20 in connection with the second of the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, verses 4 and 5. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. Why? For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God. I am an insistent upon exclusive affection. Anybody ask me what I believe to be the most important thing about the second commandment? Without any hesitation, I would answer the most important thing about the second commandment is the reason for the second commandment. It's the jealousy of God. I, Jehovah thy God, am a jealous God. The jealousy of God is violated by heathenism. Every time the heathen bows down before sticks and stones, God's jealousy burns. Now you see, that's just the opposite of what modernism teaches. Modernism teaches that when the heathen bows down before sticks and stones, God's very well pleased, because that means that people are groping in darkness for light. Oh, I tell you, when the heathen bows down before sticks and stones, God's jealousy burns. God's jealousy burns. And all Nineveh was just filled with idolatry. And God's jealousy burns. In other words, Exodus 20, verses 4 and 5 shows you why God destroyed Nineveh. Because Nineveh, with its idolatry and everything that went with it, profane the jealousy of God. What about Roman Catholic idolatry? When a Roman Catholic bows down before an image of the Virgin Mary, does God's jealousy burn? Oh, yes. Just as much as when the heathen bows down to sticks and stones. What about this? When the Roman Catholic bows down before an image of Christ, does God's jealousy burn? Somebody say, now his jealousy would burn when a Catholic bows down before an image of the Virgin Mary. But it's a different thing if he bows before an image of Christ. Oh, it's the same thing. Same thing. Because you see, God is the invisible God. He wants us to cling to him in the spirit, not in the flesh. And idolatry is clinging in the flesh. And all God's jealousy burns. That's the way the book begins. Let me give you some other verses about the jealousy of God. Exodus 34, 14. Thou shalt worship no other God, for Jehovah, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. The reason why that passage is so strong in Exodus 34, 14 is it says that that's God's name. And a name means character. He's jealous. Oh, have you ever looked up and called Jesus the chiefest among Gentiles? You say, oh, I love that. Altogether love that. Yeah. But what about this? Jealous Savior. His name is Jealous. He's insistent upon exclusive affection. Deuteronomy 4:24 says, the Lord thy God is a devourer a jealous God. The Lord thy God is a fire, a jealous God. His jealousy burns with fire. Isaiah 42:8 doesn't use the word jealousy. I am Jehovah, that is my name, but oh, I love this one. My glory will I not give to another. Then it says, neither my praise to graven images, but includes anything else. My glory will I not give to another. My glory will I not give to another. One proper application of that in your life is this. In any training or anything God gives you, you can't expect God to use you to the full unless the whole thing is geared in such a way to give God the glory. And I don't care how much you stand and say in a pious way, I just give God all the glory for this. You can't do it if your life isn't geared that way. Now, for example, what about Christians going to ungodly schools and all that sort of thing? Well, I'm not trying to solve the whole thing because Moses went and was trained in the learning of the Egyptians. You can't get away from that. But does God get all the glory when this person's used? Or does that old ungodly university get part of it? You see what I mean? If that old ungodly university gets part of the glory, God's not going to use that man to the full. I don't care how much he stands in a pious way and says, I give God all the glory for what takes place. I'd use Dr. Fleece as an illustration of this. I don't know whether you know or not, Dr. Fleece is a graduate of W&L in Lexington, Virginia, Washington Lee University. And yet, through the years, I've heard many who've been amazed at Dr. Fleece's penetration into the Scriptures, his knowledge of God, but I've never once heard anybody suggest the reason he got that is because he went to that old Washington Lee University. The only thing I've ever heard people say about him is just the opposite. How did he ever get that? I haven't gone to that old place. See what I mean? But all every now and then you hear this. Yes, I tell you, you can expect God to use him more than others because he's a university man. He's a college man. See, God doesn't get all the glory. And the fact that Dr. Fleece went to Washington Lee University doesn't keep God from getting all the glory. Not in his case. But all I want to tell you, that's a chance. God is insistent upon getting all the glory. And I believe that one of the most penetrating truths in life is this. Check your life constantly. Is your life geared to give him all the glory? I don't mean that you piously say with your lips, oh, I give you all the glory for what's happened. Is your life geared that way? This is the jealousy of God. All right, that's the first thing about God in the book of Names. God's the jealous God. Could I ask how many of you, as far as you remember, have never heard anybody preach a sermon on the jealousy of God? Oh, man. And you see, a lot of pastors give it without the word. I told you, Colossians 1:18, that's jealousy. That in all things he might have the preeminence. That he might be the one home. So you take your concordance, run it down, and get kindred words, and or ask God to fill your heart with the truth. Somebody raised a hand, I think. Had he asked, they often say that. Now I think, you see, the reference to that, Moses trained the renditions, is in Acts 7, Stephen's sermon to the Jewish Sanhedrin. And in order to get into the point of that, when they say that, they've missed the real point of what that passage is saying. There's two things that go through Stephen's sermon. One is Israel's perversity. You see, all the way through, he's talking to the Jewish Sanhedrin, and he's comparing these members of the Jewish Sanhedrin with the characters he mentions in the Old Testament. One group is Joseph's brothers that sold their kid brother into the worst slavery the world had ever known. And he compares the Jewish members of Jewish Sanhedrin with that. Boy, you get that. That thing is a knife. It really cuts. And all the way through, he's comparing these Jews who reject Christ with those perverse Israelites through the Old Testament. And man, does he ever give it in lurid detail. Then the second thing, Israel's perversity, is God's universality. The idea is that God is not confined to one particular way of doing it. He's not confined to the temple. Because, you see, they accused Stephen of speaking blasphemous words against the temple. And that was one answer that he gave there. And so, for instance, why does he quote that about Moses? Take off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place on which thou standest is holy ground. See, that ground wasn't the sacred shores of Palestine. That was far away from the sacred shores of Palestine, but holy ground because God was there. And you see, if God's universality, God is the divine. All right, now that's the background. And this used to puzzle me because it says Moses was trained in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in word and deed. And their way of interpreting that is, he was trained in all the learning of the Egyptians, therefore he was mighty in word and deed. But that misses the whole point. What he's saying is this: he was trained in all the learning of the Egyptians, and yet he was mighty in word and deed. That's what he's saying in the context. It's exactly what I was saying about Dr. Cleese. He was trained at Washington and Lee University, and yet he really came to know the Lord. See, not because of it, but in spite of it. And I think that's the context there. That used to puzzle me. I thought, I seem to see other scriptures that are different from that. And then I got the point of what he's driving at. See, the Pharisees were saying, God just can't use anything that isn't connected with the sacred shores of Palestine. And therefore, Stephen is saying Moses was trained all around the Egyptians. And he was away from Palestine when God said, the ground on which thou standest is holy ground. And yet, he was mighty in word and deed. I think that's the point of it. But that's very different from their application. Their application is, because of that, he was mighty in word and deed. Yes?
How can we give God the glory?
That's right. And, you know, some summers ago I was studying a particular part of Scripture, and John 12:28, in a special way, stood out in my mind that summer. John 12:28, Father, glorify thy name. And this little statement of five words just kept ringing in my soul. Only God can glorify God. Only God can glorify God. Now, you can misinterpret that. You say, well, I'm not God, and therefore I can't glorify him. Hold on. You see, that's where the life of Christ in me comes in. That's where the life of Christ in you comes in. Only God can glorify God. Christ liveth in me. And the simplest answer to that is just a step of faith. Father, glorify thy name. You students know how many times I've given that to you. And oh, I just love it. John 12:28. This is sort of the whole Bible. Father, glorify thy name. Father, glorify thy name. And you see, it takes a special miracle, God. You know, often I use it like this. When I preach, and sometimes when you preach, you're especially conscious of the Lord's presence. Sometimes I feel as flat as a pancake. But other times I'm conscious that God's been there, and then I find myself sort of wondering, what am I going to say to people if they thank me for the message as I shake hands afterwards and all that? And now, how can I be sure I get God's glory? You can be legalistic there and not be natural with people. You just be tied up in a knot like this, like you swallow the rainbow. I'm trying to give God all the glory. That's the best way not to do it, because that's flesh. See, that's dignified flesh, but it's still flesh. But it just gives you liberty. You just say, Father, glorify thy name. Father, glorify thy name. You'll find when he answers that, one answer often will be that folks won't think you're so hot. And you say, well, my purpose is just not to keep folks from thinking I'm hot. No, that isn't your purpose. But you get that prayer answered, and it will turn people away from you to the Lord. But the answer to that is just a step of faith. Only God can glorify God. You know, one summer, especially, those five words, you know how God often takes something in a limited part of time and sort of burns it in? And only God can glorify God. Well, you say, then, I'm not responsible. Sure I am, but how do I do it? By trusting God in me to glorify God. Well, the real answer is just a step of faith. But oh, if God doesn't get all the glory, you can't expect him to use that full. Often people ask me to pray for certain things. Now pray for a great outpouring of the Spirit. I can't. The reason I can't is it's not geared to give God all the glory. Why I know that if a great blessing comes there, God won't get all the glory. And therefore it would be contrary to the Spirit of Christ for me to pray for a thing like that. Oh, for the jealousy of God. And to grip my heart. That's the way Liam begins. Oh, I tell you, I really like this for quiet time reading, man. But I used to think, now that isn't for quiet time. I got to get something softer than that for quiet time. Because I was offline. Look at some of these other words for God's anger. Six words for God's anger. Now, a good deal of what I'm going to give you on these next words comes from Dr. Campbell Morgan on the Hebrew. The third word is vengeance. And he reminds us that vengeance is retribution, not retaliation. See the difference? God never retaliates. God takes vengeance. But he doesn't retaliate. We use the expression, get even. Well, I'm going to get even with you. I'm going to retaliate. You see, God never gets even. Vengeance is retribution, but it is not retaliation. Retaliation is a sinful thing. God never retaliates to get even. But the moral standards and character of God have been violated, not his pet feelings. You see, if you retaliate, your little sissy feelings have been violated. God doesn't have any sissy feelings. So retribution is not retaliation. Then the fourth word is anger. And Dr. Morgan says the root thought of the Hebrew word for anger is hard breathing. To get the visual image of it, you know, that Hebrew language is a great picture language, and the Greek New Testament language is a picture language. Here it is. What does it mean for God to be angry? Look like this. You know, a person so angry, sometimes he's just out of breath. That's the way God is toward sin. See, that's the Hebrew root for the word anger. Then the fifth word is indignation. And boy, is this ever shocking. Dr. Morgan says that the root thought of the Hebrew word indignation is foaming at the mouth. Does the Bible ever say God foams at the mouth? Yeah, that's what the Hebrew root here is, in the word indignation. Oh, think of that picture. You can think of a mad dog foaming at the mouth. But here's an angry God foaming at the mouth because of sin. Why? Because he's jealous. He's insistent upon exclusive affection. Well, students, do you see what I mean when I say what a tremendous picture of the anger of God this is? And through them, God is seeking to make me an angry Christian. Let me ask for a show of hands before we continue. How many of you believe it's true? You can't fully analyze in your life. But as far as you can see, it's true that you are more of an angry Christian now than you were when you began to study the prophets this last September. Could I see your hands? How many of you are? Oh, I do. I believe I am. And I don't want to be an angry Christian. Foaming at the mouth in the way God foams at the mouth, not the way man foams at the mouth. I don't expect to go around to the average group and say, I want to foam at the mouth, because they wouldn't know what I meant. But you know what I mean in terms of the context. Then your sixth word is fierceness. And Dr. Morgan says that the Hebrew word fierceness means burning. God's anger is a burning anger. Just take you to Hebrews 12:29. Our God's a consuming fire. Many times you've probably quoted and claimed that verse in the first part of Hebrews 12, 1 and 2, looking unto Jesus. Well, don't lose sight of that. That's great. But how many times have you ever quoted the last verse? Our God is a consuming fire. The burning of God. That's the second thing that makes this passage on God's anger so tremendous. And that is, there's six words which are used here for the anger of God. Oh, the word wrath. I didn't give you a comment on that particular word wrath. Just, I have no special comment. I left that out. Because just, it registers the way we ordinarily register through. The third thing which reveals the greatness of God's anger is that in Nahum 1 verses 2 to 8, there are six different illustrations of God's anger. We've mentioned the six different words for God's anger. All right, now we have six different illustrations for God's anger. And I suggest that to get these before you, just write these key words in the margin alongside the different passages. Let me give them to you and then discuss some of them. Jehovah hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm. In the margin, just write the words, a storm. Because that's the first illustration of God's anger. A storm. The clouds are the dust of his feet. Then by the second one, he rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry, and drieth up all the rivers. Bashan languisheth, and Carmel, and the flower of Lebanon languisheth. What's the word? A what? An illustration of God's anger. A drought. Did you say famine? Yes. That's the idea, but I think drought might be a little more accurate. A drought. Then, what's the third? The mountains quake at him, and the hills melt, and the earth is upheaved at his presence. The third illustrations are what? an earthquake is the third. What about this one? His wrath is poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken asunder by him. What causes that? See, his wrath poured out like fire, and the rocks are broken asunder by him. What's that? That's a volcano. See, this is God's volcanic anger. Oh, what illustrations is that? Oh, students, the more you go into this, the more you realize this is the full mention of God's anger in the Bible. You've got it all piled here, except it doesn't eternal. See, now Revelation gives the full development. It goes through eternity. And you infer that from the fact God's eternal. But oh, what a picture this is. Then the fifth one is with an overrunning flood. He will make a full end of her place. That's a flood. And then he will pursue his enemies in darkness. That's darkness. Six illustrations of God's anger. Let me give them to you again and then discuss them a little bit. A storm, he had his way in the whirlwind and storm. A drought, he rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry. An earthquake, the mountains quake at him. A volcano, his wrath is poured out like fire. A flood, with an overrunning flood, he'll make a full end. And darkness, he will pursue his enemies into darkness. Look at these just a little bit. First illustration is that of a storm. What does this mean? Jehovah hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm. This, of course, is a great picture of the sovereignty of God over the physical storm. Every time a physical storm comes, you can just stop and say, Jehovah hath his way. You don't know how much the devil's engineering that. The devil may be engineering that, but Jehovah still hath his way. And you see, it's taking the physical storm over which God is complete sovereign as a picture of his complete sovereignty over all the storms of human nature and all the storms of life. You take these riots that come. Every time you read the paper of a riot, can you stop and say, Jehovah hath his way? Oh, yes. Oh, this is a great verse on the sovereignty of God. It's one of my clinchers for the sovereignty of God in the Bible. Jehovah hath his way in the whirlwind and in the storm. And look, the clouds are the dust of his feet. You ever look up the cloud and then just thank the Lord, that cloud, it may be a very ominous cloud. But you think there's an awful lot of rain and storm in that cloud. But look at that storm cloud of judgment and just say, it's the dust of God's feet, which means God's there. God's there. Every time you see a cloud, you can say, that is the dust of his feet. God's there. God's there. And you see, what's true of that storm cloud is true of all the storm clouds of judgment connected with Nineveh. All the storm clouds of judgment indicate God is there. God is there. Oh, how tremendous this is on the sovereignty of God. That's the first illustration, is a thunderstorm. Then the second illustration is that of a drought. And watch and read this to see what kind of drought this is. He rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry. You've never seen a drought like that. You've seen a drought so great that it might dry up some rivers, but you've never seen a drought that dry up the sea. Nobody's ever concerned about the sea running dry because of the drought. But you see the illustration? This is just an unparalleled drought. Clear God with his anger. Send a drought great enough to dry up all the waters of the Atlantic Ocean. That's the kind of God we have. That's the illustration. Job at the sea. Then look at the other parts of the verse. Bashan languisheth. You know why it says Bashan? Because Bashan was very fertile pasture land over on the east of the Jordan. And it would be the last part of the country that would ever suffer from a drought. It was so fertile. You'd have to have an awful drought that would make it languish. And then it says, and Carmel. See why I mentioned Carmel? Carmel is Mount Carmel. And of course, when you think of Mount Carmel, you think of what prophet of God who had the great contest on Mount Carmel. Elijah. And you see, that was, they had water. Have you ever asked yourself, where did they get that water to pour around in the ditches and all after they had 3.5 years of drought? You see, Elijah there was not only demonstrating that God's the God of fire, but also he's the God of water. Somebody said, why? You won't stand when you run, you waste all that precious water. You see, that's why he did it up on Mount Carmel. Because Carmel had a great many springs up there. And in time of drought, that's where folks had to go to get water. That's why Elijah had the contest up on Mount Carmel after 3.5 years of drought. And so he mentions this here. He says, the drought God sends will be so great that even Carmel will like it. Even Carmel will like it. Then your third illustration is that of an earthquake. Now follow along while I read this passage and see if you can tell me what kind of an earthquake is it. The earth is upheaved at his presence, yea, the world and all that dwell therein. What kind of an earthquake? See, that's a universal earthquake. You've never had one like that. You've had your San Francisco earthquake and your Alaskan earthquake, and we're having them here and there. But you see, this is a figure of an earthquake over the whole world right at the same time. Is God great enough so he could send an earthquake over the whole world at the same time? Oh, you know, in this war situation, Vietnam, I've just often thought, why God could send an earthquake to just wipe out that whole thing over there right like that. But no, we've got to spend all our billions of dollars and everything because as a nation we substitute something for God. And he's jealous, God. He won't get all the glory for it. And therefore, he'd just be blamed for it. He won't get the glory for it. And he doesn't do it. But oh, if my life is geared to give God all the glory, all the mighty things he can do. Then your fourth illustration is a volcano. And you can see what a tremendous illustration of God's anger it is because of its mighty power and its great destructiveness. Lord, you read about that flow of lava, you know, that comes from these volcanoes. When I was out in Hawaii many years ago visiting my sister, I took an inter-island plane trip, and I went to the island of Maui. And on the island of Maui, there's the largest dormant volcano in the world, Haleakala, it's called. We went up Haleakala. Man, it's 10,000 feet high. The largest dormant volcano. And all this stuff that has spewed out and everything, oh, that's the picture of God's anger. You see, that's a God-ordained illustration. One value of these prophets is that they give you God-ordained illustrations. A lot of ours are just illustrations we drum up. But these are God-ordained illustrations. Then a flood. And did you notice this flood makes a full end of the place? Well, there's never been a flood like that. Even Noah's flood didn't do that. You see, there was still the godly remnant left over after the flood. And even Noah's flood didn't make a full end. But this is the flood that makes a full end. Then notice what the last word of this tremendous description is, the figure darkness. Darkness, that's the end. Six illustrations of God's anger. And I hope you'll want to develop these as you meditate upon the meaning of them. The fourth thing which reveals the greatness of God's anger is mentioned in the fifth line at the top of the page. What is it? Jehovah is slow to anger, and great in power, and will by no means clear the guilty. This, of course, is the long-suffering of God. And the fourth thing that shows the greatness of God's anger is his long-suffering. Well, let me ask you, what bearing does God's long-suffering have upon the destruction of ancient Nineveh? Why, you'd say God wasn't long-suffering. He destroyed ancient Nineveh. Yes. You see, that's what made the destruction so great. God's long-suffering. I think it's a great illustration of the fact that every truth of God has a tender side, but it also has a severe side. Usually when we talk about God's long-suffering, we mean just the tender side. But here's the severe side. The longer God waits to judge, the greater will be the judgment when he sends it. You see, he's given added opportunities to repent and turn to him. And the longer God waits to judge, the greater will the judgment be. Do you know how long Nineveh controlled the world as what we call the mistress of the world? History says for approximately 300 years, Nineveh was the mistress of the world. And you see, for 300 years, God was long-suffering, slow to anger, and he didn't destroy Nineveh. But oh, there's a severe side to God's long-suffering. And that the longer he waits, the greater the judgment will be. And no wonder the judgment is so terrible, according to the book of Nahum, because of God's long-suffering. You see, there's a tender side to his long-suffering, but there's a severe side. And that's what Nahum is talking about here. He used to have difficulty tying that in with the message of the book. God's slow to anger. Boy, it better sound to me like it. Sure, he's slow to anger. Therefore, the anger is so great when it has to be poured out. Let me repeat these four things that show the greatness of God's anger. and then see if you'd like to add any comments or questions. The first thing is at least 10 statements of the anger of God. The second is there's 6 different words. The third is there are 6 different illustrations. And the fourth one is God is slow to anger. God is long-suffering. Would you like to add any comments or questions? From your study, give your own heading to chapter 1 of Nahum and mention any details that emphasize this central idea. The first chapter of Nahum can be summarized in these words, God's angry judgments against Nineveh announced. God's angry judgments against Nineveh announced. Now, I used to state it like this, the doom of Nineveh announced. But you see why I changed? Because if you say the doom of Nineveh announced, you miss the God-centered atmosphere of the book. No, it isn't the doom of Nineveh announced. It's God's angry judgments on Nineveh announced. And remember, all through the book, keep coming back to this, God is the angry God. And if you find any part of it that sort of bores you, and you think, phew, this is just awful, you just come back and you won't be bored if you love the Lord. God is the angry God. Then give your heading to chapter 2 of Nahum and mention any details that emphasize this central idea. The second chapter can be summarized in these words, God's angry judgments against Nineveh describe. You see, chapter 1, the angry judgments are announced. Now in chapter 2, they're described in graphic detail. So let's turn on page 97 and get the clear description of God's angry judgments. For Jehovah restored the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and destroyed their vine branches. This is talking about Nineveh's destruction of God's people. The shield of his mighty men is made red. This is red with blood. The valiant men are in scarlet. Boy, what a picture this is. You see, this is the street scene at night when Nineveh was invaded. The chariots flashed with steel in the day of his preparation, and the cypress spears are brandished. The chariots rage in the streets. They rush to and fro on the broadways. The appearance of them is like torches. They run like the lightning. He remembereth his nobles. Now the word he means the king. He calls up his nobles. You see, to find out what to do. In other words, they have the president meets with his cabinet to get some advice what to do. They stumble in their march. Now, probably what that means is they were drunk. That's one thing that caused the destruction of Nineveh. And that is, they were drunk at the time. Now, you see why? You say, with the heathen enemy out there, why would anybody get drunk? Do you know how long the Medes and Babylonians besieged Nineveh before it fell? 3 years. So I used to have the idea they marched in and God sent the storm, that was it. But how did they all prepare? Well, they've been besieging the city for 3 years. No wonder the folks were drunk and careless, because you see, the Tigris River, where Nineveh was built, with all its canals, was considered to be an impregnable fortress. All right, now, the description here shows you how it fell. The gates of the rivers are opened, and the palace is dissolved. It is decreed she is uncovered. She is carried away, and her handmaid's moan is with the voice of doves beating upon their breasts. But Nineveh hath been from of old like a pool of water, yet they flee away. What does that mean? Probably this, that Nineveh has been as full of men as a pool is full of water. I think that's what it means. That Nineveh has been as full of men as a pool is full of water. Why does he mention this? I think the reason he mentioned it is to show how unlikely it was a fulfillment. Would you expect this to happen? Why, Nineveh has been just as full of soldiers to protect it as a pool full of water. And who would ever expect it would fall? You see, he mentions that fail to show how unlikely it is a fulfillment. Yet they flee away. Stand, stand, they cry, but none look back. Now, to what does the word they, to whom does the word they refer? Stand, stand, they cry. Evidently, the officers of the Ninevite army. They find, stand, stand, I don't want anybody to flee. But they haven't lost anything in Nineveh. I mean, I'm going to get out of here. And you see, that's the picture and description of how it fell. Now, as I mentioned in the study of the seventh principle on page 95, this passage in Nahum 2, verses 2 to 8, could be entitled, The How of Nineveh's Destruction. How does it fall? And the how of Nineveh's destruction can be summarized in these words. Nineveh was to be captured at night. You see, that's one thing Nahum gave long before it happened. That Nineveh was to be captured at night. This is a night scene with torches and so forth. Nineveh was to be captured at night by the invading army. Now you finish it for me. Through what? Nineveh was to be captured at night by the invading army. Through what? Through God's sovereign control of nature. That's how it went. Through God's sovereign control of nature. After it's been besieged 3 years, why did it fall down? Well, you notice these words, the gates of the rivers are opened and the palace is dissolved. And they contain a very accurate description of the way it fell. There was a sudden rise in the Tigris River that swept away part of the walls. And that sudden rise in the Tigris River swept away part of the walls and then opened up the city of Nineveh that was considered to be virtually impregnable. Now, I think that's one of the great thrills of studying history. Time and again, throughout the years, this is the way God has decided a battle or a war through intervening in nature. We give you just several illustrations to make it practical and up to date. One illustration is the famous Battle of Waterloo in 1815. Who was the great commander of the French army who lost to the Duke of Wellington, the British army at Waterloo? Everybody ought to know that. Old Napoleon, and you ought to know Waterloo because we use that figuratively. You meet your Waterloo, you know. We use it in a figurative sense. Do you know the decisive thing in that battle was the weather? God engineered the weather. If it hadn't been that the weather was unfavorable for Napoleon, old Napoleon wouldn't have lost that battle. But it was the weather that God used to bring the decision in the battle. Then come back to World War I. In World War I, of course, you have all your German submarines. And in the first part of World War I, we lost an awful lot of men on the high seas. It was very, very risky to send our ships across. The German submarines sank any number of our ships. Then more and more America went to its knees in World War I and cried out to God, and this wonderful thing happened. God sent a series of electric storms that swept the Atlantic Ocean almost completely free of German submarines. And they said for an almost unbelievable time, we didn't lose a single man on the high seas in World War I. We started off, we really lost them. But then God sent those electric storms that swept the Atlantic Ocean virtually free of German submarines. That's the weather again that God used. Then, do you know the great illustration of the weather God used in World War II? It's called the miracle in a certain place where the British Navy was trapped and the British press had even come out and admitted they were going to lose 300,000 men to the Germans. Because the whole British fleet pretty much was trapped. Do you know, it's called the miracle in what place, do you know?
Everybody ought to know this. World War II, these miracles done occurred. The UNKIRK considered one of the greatest miracles of World War II.
And of course, you know, we floated along pretty much as though we won the war and all. But oh, here's one of your decisive battles in the world. You see, we were greatly dependent on Great Britain. You say England and America aren't completely one. No, but they're not completely not one either. And we were greatly dependent on Great Britain. We got over there to help. Great Britain had to stand against all that German Luftwaffe and all that for a long time before we got over to help them. And that's one thing God used to save the British Navy. And it could easily have, it was one of the great turning points in the war. And again, it was the weather. Oh, then give you the tale. The British Navy was trapped there. The British press said they were going to lose 300,000. They lost about 30,000 instead of 300,000. And the reason is this, that the fog, just pieces of fog. I understand from those over in that section of the world, we don't know anything about real fog. My wife and I have gotten caught in a couple of fogs. These 6 years we've been coming from Columbia up here, but we've never seen anything like that. And the fog, just pieces of fog, closed in around Dunkirk, and almost the complete British Navy escaped unharmed. It was a weather event. And you see, here's what God did in the fall of Nineveh. It was the weather. And God sent a storm there, and it caused a sudden rise in the Tigris River that just swept away part of all. It'd been besieged 3 years, it hadn't fallen. But it's God's sovereign power working through nature. Well, I just believe God increasingly wants to work things through nature and answer to prayer. Because you see, when he does that, he gets all the glory. If he does it through human beings, usually God doesn't get all the glory. But when he does it through nature, who could give any credit to man because of man? We all think that man is going to be able to control these hurricanes by dropping all this stuff down into the hurricane and all. You know, they tried that some years back. They tried it again lately, and they don't know whether it's successful or not. Some years back, what happened was, they dropped what iodide, is that what they call it, or something like that, down into that hurricane, and the thing changed direction. Went right smack into the coast. And they had a terrific hurricane that hit the coast one time, and man tried that. And I'm not against the advance to the moon. But this whole idea of trying to control the hurricanes and everything, that's going to backfire, I believe. God is jealous for his own glory, and his jealousy burns over these things.
Could you say that the
land
of Normandy was...
That's a very good illustration of it. I was reading, I get that. The National Observer, a weekly newspaper, you know, the daily newspaper just gives it to you day by day. Breaks it up. The National Observer is a weekly newspaper, comes out of Washington, not from a Christian standpoint. This second newspaper is interesting reading, and I don't read it too thoroughly. But he had an article some time ago on Normandy, and Eisenhower, all the sales, he had a time trying to work with Churchill on that. You know, Churchill wanted to invade Normandy himself. And Eisenhower had to go to the King of England to keep old Churchill from going. Because he didn't want to be a coward, you know, he didn't want to sit on the side and just have the British go in there. Eisenhower said it would wreck Great Britain if you're killed there, if something happens to you. So he went to the king, and the king of England told Churchill, he said, if you go, I'll go too. Churchill said, no, you're the king of England, you must go. He said, well, then you stay away, I'm going to go. That's the only way they got old Churchill to stay away. Yeah, I like those things on the side like that, don't you? National Observer. But one thing it said was this, Eisenhower kept studying that. And one thing about Normandy and the English Channel over there, and they had to go across, was the great uncertainty of the weather. Oh, tremendously uncertain. And he wasn't sure until the time they kept studying, and oh, Eisenhower kept in touch with the official weather forecast. You know how we were checking for a football game or something like that. But man, when you've got thousands of men under your control and their lives are like that, you know you'd be concerned about the weather. And Eisenhower had to go into that thing. I read it after I died. See, that's when the National Observer had it. And he said, the weather was very favorable for us at that time, and we marched over Detroit. Sure, it's another one. I got to answer that. I forgot. But that's the Normandy invasion. And again, what the how of Nineveh's destruction? It's right in these verses. Nineveh was to be captured at night by the invading army through God's sovereign control of nature. Chapter 3 from your study, give your own heading to the third chapter, ma'am, and mention any details to emphasize this central idea. Third chapter of Nahum can be summarized in these words. God's angry judgment against Nineveh vindicated. All right, now notice the three chapters. Chapter 1, God's angry judgment announced. See, just give the broad pronunciation in terms of God's anger. Then chapter 2, God's angry judgment described. You have a great description of how Nineveh's going to fall. Then chapter 3, God's judgment vindicated. And you see, when he vindicates God's judgment, he describes in detail the awful sinfulness of Nineveh. And says, God is righteous in sending judgment. He vindicates the righteous judgments of God. Nineveh is commonly regarded as the most brutal of the ancient heathen nations. And this third chapter is a vivid description of the awful brutality of Nineveh. Let me give you several verses. Chapter 3, verse 1 says, woe to the bloody city. The literal Hebrew there is very expressive. Woe to the bloody city. woe to the city of blood drops. That's a little easier. Isn't that expressive? Oh, that God's angry judgment vindicated. Why did God have to judge Nineveh like that? Because it is a city of blood drops. City of blood drops. And it means the shedding of human blood. Why did God have to judge Germany? Hitler, all blood drops. Blood drops. God's anger burned within when he saw all the Hitler did. And I tell you, you just start with some powder it takes to blow you up with. If you could read of Nazi atrocities in World War II and not just have righteous indignation figure being, but your indignation is just a picture of how God burned when all that was taking place. Then chapter 3, verses 2 and 3, gives a vivid description that sometimes misinterpreted and misapplied. Some people think that chapter 3, verses 2 and 3 is describing the fall of Nineveh. No, chapter 2, verses 3 and 4 is describing the fall of Nineveh. But chapter 3, 2 and 3 is describing Nineveh's invasion of other countries. And the amazing thing is this. Chapter 2, 3 and 4 is very similar. Chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. You see why? Because the point is, Nineveh fell. Nineveh was treated the same way she treated other nations. Now listen to this, Nahum 3, 2 and 3. Now this isn't Nineveh being invaded. This is Nineveh invading other nations. Boy, look at how vivid this is. The noise of the whip and the noise of the rattling of wheel. You couldn't get much more vivid than this, could you? And prancing horses, and bounding chariots, the horsemen mounted, and the flashing swords, and the glittering spears, and a multitude of slain, and a great heap of corpses. And there's no end of the bodies. They stumble from their bodies. I see that in Nineveh's treatment of other nations. All right, I'll come back to that line. Let's want to read names 2, 3, and 4, which is Nineveh's destruction. Shield of his mighty men is made red, the valiant men are in sorrow. The chariots flashed with steel in the day of preparation, the sight of fear to brand it. The chariots raged in the streets, they rushed to and fro the broadways, the appearance of his light torches, they run like lightning. I put two passages together on one illustration, number 3223. You know what number 3223 says? I'm sorry, you can. Be sure you're saying. We'll find out. Now notice it does say, be sure your sin will be found out. That's the way we often apply. It doesn't always then say that. Sometimes when your sin finds you out, it's found out, but not always. God doesn't say your sin will always be found out, but it says, of course, it will always. We know it before the judgment of God. But be sure your sin will find you out. And those two passages taken together are great illustrations. They give you one more illustration of Nineveh's great wickedness. It's in chapter 3, verse 4. In Nahum 3, 4, twice God uses this word for Nineveh's sin. What book in the Old Testament does automatically take you back to? It's the word whoredoms. Twice in verse 4 of chapter 3, God speaks of the whoredoms of Nineveh. And once he talks about the harlot. He says the whoredoms of the well-favored harlot. I think what he's saying is, the whoredoms of the big fat harlot. That's what he's saying. That automatically takes you back to what book that we studied earlier this semester? Hosea. But you see the difference? You say, well, God's people, Israel, could commit whoredom. They are married to the Lord. But a heathen nation couldn't. Yes, it could. See, it uses the word whoredom for a heathen nation just to use it for Israel. And so that's one thing I mean when I say that Nahum brings to a climax what you've got about God's angry judgment. Or I see more and more the providential arrangement of God. Y'all see, we've had a lot about judgment earlier. But how many of you think you see that this book, more than the ones we've had earlier, is designed to take you into the anger of God? How many of you think you see that? See, there's a providential arrangement. That's why I bring that to a climax in the diagram. And whoredom, yeah, whoredom of Israel. Israel's heart. But not the heathen. Yeah, the heathen too. Because the word is used for Nineveh just as it is used for Israel. show how the closing verses of Nahum are fitting conclusions to the entire book. They're fitting conclusions because they emphasize this solemn fact. And I'll express it in terms of an often used illustration. Solemn fact. You see, here's the very close. It says, upon whom hath not thy wickedness gone continually? And it shows that's God's justice indicated. It's a fitting conclusion because it emphasizes the solemn fact that sin is a boomerang. Y'all know that illustration. Often in children's toys you have that. And that would be my children's object lesson for Nahum if I could find one. If any of you know where I can get a good boomerang, I would love for you to let me know. You got one? And the king one? They are thin. They are dangerous to have around them. Is there any danger of anybody getting hurt through it? I don't want to use a dangerous object lesson. I'd like to be spiritually dangerous, but not literally so. I don't just pay, just cross a little bit. I said, I'm going to give you $1 for it. Might be a bit cheap. Sin is a boomerang. You know the old adage, chickens come home to roost. Well, that's the way the end goes. Chickens come home to roost because of the mighty hand of God. All right, let's have a break.